Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a special privilege and pleasure to welcome to these microphones once again Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama. He represents the people of the 5th District there with great distinction. This is the latest incarnation in a distinguished record of public service at both the local, state, and federal level. He has been a district attorney, a prosecutor, an assistant attorney general, a county commissioner, a state legislator, and now a 5-term member of the United States House of Representatives. He's a man of courage and conviction. He is also a candidate for the United States Senate. Congressman Brooks, it is terrific to have you back. You have conducted one of the most important of your many acts of public service, in my estimation, sir, with your interview of Dr. Li Mengyan, a Chinese defector who has been warning about what she learned inside the Chinese biological warfare program, about what it's up to. And I wanted specifically to ask you about her insights and your takeaway from this conversation you had with her recently about the coronavirus pandemic that has been foisted upon us by the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, to me, the fake news media has badly misled the American people for a year and a half concerning the origins of COVID-19. I stated in 2020 that it was my belief, based on the evidence that I had access to, including various scientific and medical statements, that COVID-19 originated in the Communist Chinese Party's Wuhan bioweapons lab, that was not the issue. The issue is whether COVID-19 was released accidentally or recklessly because of improper containment measures, or whether it was released intentionally by the People's Liberation Army of Communist China as part of an experiment to determine how rapidly one of their bioweapons would move across the globe. I don't know the answer to that question as to whether it was negligent or reckless on the one hand or intentional on the other. The Communist Chinese Party leadership knows the answer to that question. Certainly, what we have seen with Dr. Li Mengyan is scary.
It is indeed. One of the things that may be instructive about this question of accident or intentionality is something the Chinese Communist Party's Centers for Disease Control participated in, as you may know, Congressman Brooks, back in October of 2019. About a month before the first manifestations of this disease. It was called Event 201. It was sponsored by Bloomberg and the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, the World Economic Forum at Davos, and the Rockefeller Foundation, the Gates Foundation, among others. The concern is that this really represented a template, this war game, if you would, tabletop exercise for how a pandemic coronavirus disease-driven, you know, public health catastrophe could translate into improvements in world domination or world governance. And I just have to say, all of these are sort of elements of what we are probably dealing with here. But you're right, we don't know for sure whether it was intentional or not. But it certainly has been, I think, increasingly clear that it came from China, and deliberately so, in terms of the provenance of the disease. And I'd like to ask you, if I could, about the role of the United States government, specifically Tony Fauci's National Institute of Infectious and Allergies. This raises a question, does it not, about our own involvement in what has come about in this disaster?
Senator Rand Paul has done an excellent job of throwing light on the federal government's role in the creation of COVID-19. It's very disappointing to hear that the federal government actually put in money that eventually was used at the Wuhan bioweapons lab for who knows how many different nefarious purposes. Certainly gain of function for these viruses was one of the things that Senator Rand Paul has been able to bring out and shed light on. And just so that the listeners understand what we're talking about, when you use the phrase gain of function, basically what that means is that something, in this case a virus, is being altered by humans to change the functions of a virus. And in this particular case with COVID-19, the evidence is growing that the gain of function we're talking about was to make the virus much more dangerous and contagious to humans. Now, that begs the question, why would anyone take a virus and make it more dangerous to human life unless it's part of a weaponization program?
I think I can understand pretty clearly, especially, and we'll talk about this more in a moment, Congressman, the larger purpose of these Chinese biological weapons programs and activities. But the question, I guess, is why would Tony Fauci want to underwrite such research? And it's been said, well, it's so as to be better prepared for the emergence of such diseases and to have, you know, vaccines and so on available to contend with them at the time. Do you find that to be persuasive, or is this otherwise really inexcusable behavior on his part?
Well, I would like to give Dr. Fauci the benefit of the doubt. I would hate to think that Dr. Fauci intentionally aided and abetted the Communist Chinese Party and the weaponization of this virus. But you also have to understand the Communist Chinese Party and Communist China's leadership. These people are very clever, they're very smart, and they know how to move pawns on a large chessboard. I suspect that it's much more likely that the Communist Chinese Party saw an opportunity to use its various leverage points to cause the United States government to help pay for the Communist Chinese Party's bioweapons program.
Congressman Mo Brooks, let me ask you about what you've learned from Dr. Li Menyang about this program more broadly, not just the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but other facilities in China that are involved in developing diseases that could be used with devastating effect, and specifically insights she has had about who the targets might well be of such efforts.
Sure, but just for a moment of clarity, I met with Dr. Yan, but I don't want it to seem that it was just me and her. This was a meeting put together by the House Freedom Caucus, and we had probably a dozen or so other congressmen who were also in this meeting making statements to and issuing questions to Dr. Yan. So it was a collective effort by the House Freedom Caucus to uncover a lot of the things that have transpired. Now,
and if I could just ask you a question on that point, sir, if I may.
Yeah.
Did you find her credible? Because there are people who have suggested that she doesn't know what she's talking about. I wonder what your thoughts were about that and those of your colleagues, for that matter.
I have no reason to disbelieve her. Bear in mind that I had reached this conclusion before the meeting that we had with Dr. Yan. Now, Dr. Yan was able to give us much more detail, much more evidence in particular about where Communist China is coming from. And people need to keep in perspective the dangers associated with Communist China and how the United States of America is to a very large degree funding Communist China's military. Now, we're doing it through very poor trade policies that President Trump tried to improve, but was unsuccessful in improving for a variety of political reasons that unfortunately don't have merit and undermine the United States of America. But Communist China is not our friend.
And also, by the way, enormous amounts of money being transferred from our capital markets.
Well, Communist China, they're very clever. They're very smart. They know how to push the political levers in the United States of America, and in particular, Washington, D.C. They're very good at inducing American citizens or special interest groups to do Communist China's bidding. Granted, they don't do it because they're in love with Communist China. They do it out of self-interest, or maybe they'll make a little bit more money, as the case may be. But to throw all that behind us for a moment, the principal message is this. Communist China has shown itself to be very aggressive and very belligerent. They're advancing in the South China Sea. Most recently, They've even tossed out the public possibility of invading Taiwan. They've also tossed out the public possibility of nuclear weapons being used against Japan, should Japan adhere to its treaty obligations with Taiwan. You've got Communist China's military having published books and made public statements to the effect that World War III is most likely to be fought with biological weapons as opposed to nuclear weapons. And you've got all of the things that the Communist Chinese Party is doing to advance their biological weapons capability, and they're doing it in earnest, leaving the rest of the world behind. They have even, according to Dr. Yan, tried to obtain the ability to develop killer bioweapons that target specific races or ethnicities across the globe. That's abhorrent.
Yes, sir. And especially so because according to a former defense minister of China, Chi Haoqian, Deng Xiaoping, the then general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, reportedly set this illegal biological warfare program up in the first place for the purpose of depopulating the United States so it could be colonized by Chinese with their excess population. So these are not simply abstract concerns, especially against the backdrop, as you were saying, sir, of the recent horrific experience with this pandemic engineered in their biological warfare facilities to lay low both this country and others by the millions around the world. And to your point about tailoring biological weapons so as to take out certain populations. Dr. Li Menyang, I gather, knows whereof she speaks about this. She's seen it from inside the belly of the beast, if you will, has she not? And again, that's persuasive, I take it, to you and your colleagues.
She is a medical doctor. She has a PhD. She's a virologist. And yes, she was inside Communist China. She is a Communist China citizen. Now, she fled, she defected Communist China after COVID-19 began spreading across the globe because she learned from firsthand testing and experience and knowledge that COVID-19 was man-made, and that ran contrary to the propaganda of Communist China. And that meant that her life was at risk. So she has put her own life at risk by coming to the United States of America, by escaping Communist China, and her life today is at risk of being taken. There are apparently efforts, according to Dr. Yan, efforts to either kill her or capture her and return her to Communist China. This woman has shown a tremendous amount of bravery to try to help the world understand what's going on, but at the same time, she is up against Communist China's disinformation and propaganda campaign, and so there are significant efforts by Communist China to disparage her credibility. But I'd ask anyone to look at the statement that she gave us in the House Freedom Caucus this week. And it's pretty compelling, and it's very scary, very illuminating. And America and the world better wake up before it's too late.
Amen. I want to come to next what we should be doing about this besides waking up to it. But just a quick aside, I was impressed in your report on her conversation with you all that she really had emphasized how integral the disinformation and propaganda activities of China are in their biological warfare program, dissembling about its existence, of course, because it is illegal under their treaty commitments under the Biological Weapons Convention, sir. But also, when you have an outbreak like this one with the, well, I call it the CCP virus, the COVID-19, they've gone to great lengths not just to discredit her, of course, but also to dissemble about it coming not from their laboratory, but from a wet market or from Fort Detrick, one of our own biodefense facilities here in the United States. So this is a really important insight as well. But let me turn, if I could, with you, Congressman Brooks, to the question of what should we be doing in the face of all of this? And I had some thoughts, and I wanted to just run them by you. Obviously, holding the Chinese accountable for what has been done in this COVID exercise is step one, which raises a question of reparations, I think, as well as obviously shutting down the sorts of collaboration that have taken place, not just in Wuhan, but apparently in quite a number of facilities here in the United States where some of their People's Liberation Army specialists have been allowed to work and do research and collect intelligence.
One of the first things that the world's nations should do is demand reparations, compensation for the damages caused by Communist China. It does not make any difference with respect to COVID-19, whether Communist China was negligent or reckless or intentional in their bad conduct. Roughly 4 million lives have been lost, if you believe the official statistic. And granted, there is some fudge factor involved with those official statistics as to cause of death being COVID-19 versus any of a number of other factors. But there's been trillions of dollars in damages in the United States alone, just at the federal government level, the relief packages that have been sent out. Then you've got compensation for the 600,000 plus Americans who have lost their lives in whole or in part because of COVID-19. Then you've got the economic disruption to the individual lives of Americans, to businesses, to people who have lost their jobs and no longer have a livelihood. Communist China ought to be held accountable for that. The United States of America has the ability to force Communist China to be responsible for that or risk losing all trade with the United States of America. That's our leverage point. We have a $400 billion plus trade deficit each year with Communist China. That's where America, we're hemorrhaging our wealth to Communist China. And we need to put a stop to it for no other reason that they're using that wealth they get from us to build up their military capabilities that put us at greater risk. So there are plenty of things the United States can do, but we need to stand tall. If this had happened in the United States of America and had been an American lab, if it had been one of our pharmaceutical companies' labs, they would have been held accountable in a court of law.
You can count on
Communist China, same principle should apply.
Amen. And I think similarly, along with trade, we ought to make sure that we're not continuing to put U.S. investors' money into People's Liberation Army companies and the CCP more generally. Let me turn. You're a member of the House Armed Services Committee, a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Mo Brooks. Other pieces of this that would seem to be in need of urgent attention as well are exposing fully the scope of the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program and ramping up our biodefense capabilities. Would you agree?
Absolutely, particularly on the defense capabilities part. But we also need to send a very stern message to Communist China that if there is any kind of attack made by Communist China using bioweapons, that falls under our mutually assured destruction doctrine that triggers the use of nuclear weapons. And hopefully that threat of the use of nuclear weapons will deter Communist China from continuing to advance their bioweapons program, even to the point of considering its use.
Yeah, deterrence
is
critical.
The first finger, if that happens, is to point it at China. You know, there's part of Communist Chinese strategy is to ensure that if they implement their bioweapons strategy, that there's some uncertainty as to the origin point of the biological weapon. So it's difficult to point the finger at China. Well, we need to make sure China understands that if there is anywhere on the planet something that appears to be man-made, that is a biological weapon, that one of the first and primary suspects is Communist China, and that we will use our military to defend and respond to any kind of biological attack here against America or against any of our allies around the globe.
Amen. Congressman Mo Brooks, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time today, sir, and for your great service to our country. Best of luck in your future political purposes, and we look forward to talking with you more about all of this. In the meantime, stay well, sir. Next up, former Israeli parliamentarian Rabbi Yehuda Glick on the state of U.S.-Israeli relations and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're going to visit for this next segment with a man I've heard of for some time, but have only just met by phone today. His name is Rabbi Yehuda Glick. He is a former parliamentarian in Israel, an American who made Aliyah from the United States and is now a citizen of the State of Israel. He was a candidate for the Likud Party's nomination to be president of Israel, and is these days the president of the Shalom Jerusalem Foundation. A lot to talk about with him about what's going on in Israel at the moment and the U.S.-Israeli relationship and more. Rabbi, it's very good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you so much, Frank. And it's really wonderful to be here in the United States of America, Israel's greatest ally since President Harry Truman.
It certainly has been. And I hope that will continue to be the case under the present administration. We'll come to that in a moment. But first, I was commenting on another radio program yesterday about a perception that I have that the state of Israel's status, or at least its situation, has changed rather markedly over the past 7 months, in part from the high point of Donald Trump's presidency and the very close relationship that he had with your former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the kind of things that they did together in terms of recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the movement of the embassy, the recognition of Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, and of course, not least, the Abraham Accords, to a situation in which Israel finds itself now with a parlous situation, I think it's fair to say, in terms of its government, and difficulties with the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and questions being raised by the U.S. government, it seems, about a number of things, including how it wishes to see Jerusalem treated as the unified capital city of Jerusalem. Give us sort of the 30,000-foot perspective, if you would, Rabbi, as to how things look from Israel in those regards.
I mean, Frank, first, I'll be glad to, as you said, really, Donald Trump was a wonderful friend of former Prime Minister Netanyahu. I just want to start off, as I said before, the United States of America has been Israel's greatest ally since day one for President Harry Truman until today with all the administrations. Some of the administrations, the chemistry between the president and the prime minister were on a higher level, and some of them there were friction. But always, United States of America has been Israel's greatest ally. I can say that the peak of everything was definitely the time of Donald Trump, who we like said, if he does one of like 10 things, he will be it'll be wonderful. But I think he did at least 9 of them. That means recognizing Jerusalem as the capital, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing the legal settlement in Judea and Samaria, recognizing that BDS is anti-Semitism, recognizing the annexation of the Golan Heights, and several more issues. And I think that Donald Trump and then Netanyahu saw things eye to eye, which has definitely brought Israel and brought the whole region into a much better situation, including the, as you mentioned, the Abraham Accords, something that we could not have dreamed of just a few years ago, that's 5 different peace treaties. But I think the peak of all was the cancel when Donald Trump realized that the agreement with Iran was endangering the state of Israel, and he totally canceled it. Unfortunately, President Biden came into power, and his cooperation with the Palestinians, meaning tolerating terror attacks, meaning supporting and being a little bit more tolerant to things like legitimizing terror, and trying to make treaty with Detroit, trying to make this treaty with Iran is something that definitely raises worries. Now, I can't say that President Biden is not a friend of Israel. He tries to be. But on the same time, he's trying to play politically correct with some of the world's greatest evil people. And here we have to be very clear, because when you try to satisfy people who are leading terrorism, you are not promoting peace. You are giving the terrorists, the people, an appetite to do more. And we have to be very clear. Radical Islam, radical political Islam is something that is very cruel. It's something that has to do with leading terror, and we have to be very careful. It does not mean that we're not for making peace. I said, as I said before, the Abraham Accords was wonderful. Israel would love to make peace with Muslim countries, like even like the biggest one, like Indonesia. But we cannot tolerate any kind of promoting terror, any kind of country that calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. We cannot tolerate the fact that the Palestinian Authority is allowing terrorist organizations like Hamas and the jihadists for the Islamic Jihad to freely work in Judea and Samaria. And these are things that the president of the United States, Biden, has to be aware of.
And oppose it. Let me ask you, Rabbi, you mentioned Hamas and Islamic Jihad operating in the West Bank areas, Judea and Samaria, as they're historically known. They've also, of course, been operating out of Gaza. And there was a recent, very ugly war between Palestinians in Gaza and Israel, in which large numbers of rockets and missiles and the like were sent from Gaza into Israeli communities without regard for human life. The Israeli military, as it assiduously does, sought to retaliate decisively, but with great regard for human life on the other side, particularly civilian life. How would you net out where things stand now in the wake of essentially the suspension of those hostilities, but clearly not the resolution of the underlying conflict?
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, every few years, the Palestinians, the radical Palestinian organizations from Gaza try to check us out, see how we were going to respond. And last time, when Prime Minister Netanyahu was in power, we didn't tolerate anything, and we definitely gave back a quite clear answer. On the one hand, the Iron Dome, which we received from the United States, support of and that protected our citizens. At the same time, we passed on a message to the Palestinians in Gaza that we are not going to tolerate it. And Israel, though, was very careful not to damage innocent civilians. We were totally not going to tolerate anything else. What is going to happen the next time? God forbid. We don't know, and we hope that the present administration, just like the previous one, will support and understand that the security of the state of Israel is important for the United States of America and is important for anybody who believes in freedom of in a democratic country, the only democratic country in the Middle East. But I want to point out that the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad organizations are trying to use another so-called sensitive place to raise and to encourage incitement and harassment and terror, and that is the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount, which is the holiest place in the world for all believers in the Bible, and we at shalomjerusalem.org are promoting the centrality of this place once and again that the Palestinians are trying to use to exploit this holy place and to promote terror from the holy mosque. And I can't believe that anybody in the world will think that a house of prayer should be used as a house of incitement, harassment, and promoting prayer terror. And we have to be very clear. The United States administration has to condemn and not tolerate any kind of violence coming from the Temple Mount or using the Temple Mount as an excuse. And
I'm not sure that we've heard that clarity out of the Biden team. If anything, I'm very concerned, and I imagine you are, Rabbi Yehuda Glick, about the Biden administration's reported interest in opening a consulate in East Jerusalem, essentially a consulate for, you know, the Palestinians, even a sort of embassy to the Palestinians there. Talk a little bit about how that fits into this this larger context of the struggle over Jerusalem as the unified and capital of Jerusalem of Israel itself.
Yeah, I'll just remind the listeners that in the first 19 years of the state of Israel, Jerusalem was divided. And that meant that we had Jordanian soldiers shooting at civilians every other day in Jerusalem. At the end of the Six-Day War in 1967, Jerusalem was united. And we don't have those snipers in Jerusalem shooting at civilians. And that's the way it has to remain. And every single time anybody talks or anybody hints a possibility of dividing Jerusalem, it gives those extreme zealot organizations an appetite to try to once again convince the world that it'll be peaceful if we divide Jerusalem. And here is one thing that I said Donald Trump understood, and he agreed that President Trump said that Jerusalem will not be divided. And I think that this message has to continue because Jerusalem is united And that means we're a democratic state, but Jews and Arabs can work together, live together, but it is only one city. It's a city of God. It's the city of the holiest city in the world, the city of God's throne in the world, the divine presence of God in the world. And this is what it's a biblical city, and it has to continue being in the hands of those who are promoting peace. And dividing Jerusalem will not lead to peace. Vice versa, it will guide and encourage those who are looking to raise the tension in the region. And we saw again and again, people were telling us, no, if we go harsh against the Palestinian terrorist organizations, there's going to be war. We saw the 4 years of President Trump were the four most safe years, least terror attacks in the area for several decades. So we have to understand very clearly the right way to deal with terror organizations is not to give in to them, but rather to be very stubborn and determined to fight them.
Rabbi Glick, one other facet of this recent conflict, which seems, as I understand it, to be a continuing problem even after the cessation of the latest round of hostilities, namely attacks on Israeli Jews by Israeli Arabs, something we haven't seen, I think, since essentially the founding of the Jewish state. What was that about? How did it come about? And if it is indeed ongoing, what are its implications?
Yeah, this is definitely, you put your finger exactly on a very worrying issue. The Arab, the Israelis, who were living coexistent or living peacefully in Israel, the deserving complete all civil rights. I mean, they vote for the Knesset, they get their members of Knesset, and they get and they're part of Israeli society. And suddenly, when the Hamas called out for a religious war against Israel, suddenly we found ourselves in some of these mixed communities, Arab citizens of Israel, going out and cruelly attacking Jewish citizens, cars, houses, schools, synagogues. This was very worrying. I must say it surprised us all. It surprised people who really believe in peace. And this is something that has raised in Israel a discussion. And I think the message to the Arab population is now becoming very, very clear. You want to live peacefully amongst us? You're welcome to do so. But if you think that with the tolerance of the Israeli society towards the Arabs living amongst us is a sign of weakness, you think that our reaction towards violence is just like a wink of the eye and we're going to ignore it, no way. No way. We are not going to allow people from amongst our citizens to fight against Israel and to endanger and risk the stability of the state of Israel.
Yeah, it's eminently sensible, of course. I think in any society that would be the case. Let me ask you to turn to the threat that you described at the outset, Rabbi, and that is from the Islamic Republic of Iran. And what we are witnessing, especially with respect to the efforts being made by the Biden administration to resuscitate this odious so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and otherwise, I'm fearful, not just empower, but embolden the mullahs of Tehran. Where does this currently stand as you see it, and what are the implications for Israel, and what is Israel going to do in the event that something like this eventuates?
I must say that the Israeli society is unanimously against the treaty with Iran, and I think Prime Minister Netanyahu managed to convince President Trump, and they were hand by hand, understanding the danger of making any kind of treaty with a terror country. Unfortunately, it seems like the Biden administration are once again making that same mistake as President Obama did, and trying, let's give them a chance. But when you give terror a chance, it is a very great risk for the stability of the Middle East. It's a great, it's a danger for people who truly believe in a God whose name is Shalom, whose name is peace. And I think we have to be anybody here in America has to alert the risk and be very concerned. And I think anything we can do to warn the present administration about the dangerous impacts that something like that can happen are extremely important. And therefore, I call upon the Biden administration, please sit with the Israelis. We are very professional about this issue. We know that we have a wonderful intelligence. We have all the information, and we can show it to you. And giving in to pressure from the world is not for the sake of peace in the region. And the way we saw when the tough hand against terror was strong, we managed to sign 5 peace treaties in the region with Bahrain, with the Emirates, with the Saudis, who hate Iran just as much as we do. And therefore, the right way to do it is to understand who are the evil and who are the good.
Right. I don't know that you quite got to a peace agreement with the Saudis, though that may have been offing had it been given another chance.
We did it with Oman.
But you had
Sudan,
you certainly had a working
relationship. Under the ground, under the carpet, as they say, Israel and Saudi Arabia are working closely. For political reasons, the Saudis did not finally signed the treaty, and that's your profession, you know better than I do. But I can say that the relationships between Israel and Saudi Arabia are greater. For the first time, the leaders of Saudi Arabia came out very, very clearly against the Palestinian political authority. And officially, they didn't sign a peace treaty. We were very close. I am sure if President Trump would have continued, we would already be behind that, after that already also. I do hope that the President Biden understands the importance. Can you imagine if Israel and Saudi Arabia are living on their peace treaty? I think it would change the world.
It would reshape that region, that's for sure. I'm so grateful for your time, Rabbi Yehuda Glick, for your vision of a more peaceful Middle East and what needs to be done to try to get us there, and how close we were under the previous administration to real breakthroughs. And I hope that we will, in fact, as you say, God's ears, we will see it done under this administration as well. In the meantime, sir, thank you so much for your insights. I hope you'll come back to us here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to talk with you. We'll speak with
thank you
someone
so
else
much, and God bless
right
you.
After this. Thank you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Robert Charles, a man who we are privileged to have as a featured part of this program with regularity. He is a distinguished public servant, having served as a naval intelligence officer, as a counsel in the George H.W. Bush and Reagan White Houses. He is also the former Assistant Secretary of State for Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs during the George W. Bush administration. He is a principal of the Charles Group. He is author of Eagles and Evergreens, and he is also a spokesman for a terrific organization, the Association of Mature American Citizens. Robert Charles, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, always good with you, particularly in tumultuous times.
They are indeed, and I wanted to talk to you about one of the reasons why. I've come to conclude, Robert, and I wanted to get your thoughts about it, that the Biden administration would properly be better understood as a wrecking operation than just another administration. We're watching a lot of really bad things happening on its watch and to some extent as a result of its policies, and look no further than what it is doing deliberately at the U.S. border with Mexico. Talk about what's happening there, Bobby, and based on your extensive experience with government and law enforcement affairs, the implications of it.
Well, I think, Frank, that to me is just one dimension of a multidimensional failure of coherent domestic and international policy. And I think part of what people have to remember is that even in that context where I talk about an individual dimension, these things are all tied together. The international threats we confront that you are so really focused in many cases on are perfectly linked with the domestic threats that we face. And the border is one of the seams that holds, unfortunately, those two threat sets together. What's happened at the border is that we've largely given it up. We've diluted our own ability to enforce rule of law inside the country by believing that we don't even need to telegraph to the world that we believe in it anymore. We We've come to the view that we will diminish and we will demoralize our law enforcement, federal, state, and local, and this is particularly so at the border, by permitting record inflows of drugs that kill Americans every day. Never mind the potential for terrorists around the world, which grows with every week that we continue to keep open borders. You know, we experienced the national data from last week show that we saw a 30% increase in overdoses last year. We have never, ever seen anything like that. And you can blame COVID, but really, not really. The 91,000 young people who died of overdoses last year is a direct function of the fingers of the terrorist, but in particular, I'd say terrorists, really what I mean is drug trafficking organizations that have reached states and grabbed us and grabbed the next generation by the throat. So what does the border abdication mean? It means security inside the United States is at risk.
Yeah, throughout the United States too, not just in the border states, of course. And that's really frightening as well, especially when COVID-19 is likely coming along with all of those people, if not, malign intents. They pose potentially a significant public health risk as well. Let me ask you about more generally homeland security. Bobby, you've again spent a lot of time in this space. We are told endlessly that the threat we face here at home is from white supremacists rather than a variety of Marxist organizations and, I think supremacists of other stripes, shall we say. What's your take on what the Biden administration is doing in that space as well?
Well, I think it's my own instinct is that it's a deflection. I mean, we all know that from CRT and its Marxist principles to the promotion of these Marxist organizations that were heavily involved in all of the rioting in 200 cities last year and have been this year. We know that these things are driven by both foreign and domestic Marxist influences. So that Marxism is about justice coming through the barrel of a gun, not in courts of law. And so the gist here is that by deflecting to other issues, I'm not saying that there aren't some racists in the United States that need to be reeducated, and to the extent they commit crimes, they need to be punished properly. But the reality is that you've got this is really disproportionate. What we're facing is an attack on the values embodied in our Bill of Rights, and that attack comes from Marxist-Leninists and Maoists who are clearly seeing an opportunity in the Biden administration. And why? Because you have a young, disorganized socialist mentality in part of it. And in the other part of it, you have a doddering sort of inability to coherently make and stick with policy. Even some green press is beginning to recognize that the State Department, Homeland Security, and Defense are going a bit wobbly. And, you know, our foreign adversaries don't see that. Of course they do.
Bobby, let me just touch on the military and then we'll turn to some of those foreign problems. You've served in uniform. You have a keen appreciation for the importance of unit cohesion and good order and discipline, as it said, in the ranks, to the warfighting effectiveness, to the readiness of our military. What is being done that is diminishing all of that by this Biden team?
Gosh, you know, it's such a poignant question. The word readiness is really at the center of everything. So I like to think that I'm part of the AMAC generation, as you are, to say conservative 50, and I always drive people back to AMAC.us, but there's a reason. And the reason is that 76% of that group are actually families with veterans of one kind or another in the family. Veterans know that readiness is at the center. It doesn't matter whether you're talking World War II, whether you're getting prepared to for a parachute jump, or whether you're an intelligence officer, it doesn't matter. It's all about capability and readiness. You know, when you put an E on your uniform as an expert shot, it isn't because somebody said, close enough, or you're color means you only need to get this far in, or no, you either hit the bullseye repeatedly or you don't. And the bottom line is that's exactly how combat is constructed. Now I spent some time in Afghanistan and Iraq. I was active duty for a short period of time. I've been in a combat zone. I've never been in combat, but I'm telling you that the readiness piece of this, unit cohesion, the ability to understand chain of command, the idea that merit is how you win wars, that's morale. Merit and morale or how you win more. And what they've done is they've undermined both of them inside this Pentagon.
They have indeed. And the whole critical race theory business is an overlay, crippling.
The whole idea of critical race theory. So I know I'm driving a little bit at AMAC right now, but their entire magazine that is about to hit mailboxes in 2.4 million homes is about the fact that America is the least racist country in the history of mankind, and that there are seven hard facts that completely dispose of this critical race theory idea, which is to take guilt related to racism and rebrand that guilt in the context of the Marxist proletariat bourgeoisie economic class system, and essentially rebrand Marxism as somehow not only acceptable but necessary, because we will now suddenly accept that there is no upward mobility in America. Skin color defines everything. Critical race theory is a direct attack on Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln. It's not just an attack on us. So I think people get deep and understand this, because, you know, the two before that hits you over the head is the one you don't see.
Bobby, so let me turn to what the wrecking operation has applied to these various institutions that are vital to our security as a people, as a nation, mean in, as you say, a turbulent world. Let's start with what's been going on in Cuba lately as a reminder of just how toxic this Marxist doctrine and agenda actually is, and how dangerous it is for us to be sort of blindly ignoring the assault we're under from its adherents.
You know, I think one of our biggest enemies, Frank, and it's the biggest enemy of the millennial generation in particular, some of those who are older struggle with it, but not as much, is ignorance. And people don't understand that the rough tally of those that have been killed, I mean, killed, detained and killed, tortured and killed, or taken off the street and forever perished in Cuba between 1959 and today exceeds 100,000 people. That there was a short window in the 1970s when 14,000 people were killed. The point is that, and that's the most extreme, of course, but the suppression of all the rights that we think of as critical in our Bill of Rights, that these rights that we just take for granted, what we're doing right now, talking as the press, talking as people, talking, moving around wherever we wish to go as a matter of assembly, or never mind assembly for grievance, or protecting our families, and all of those rights, the right not to be held captive without due process, the right to a fair trial, to confront your accusers, all of those things are not existent in a communist country like Cuba, like Laos, like the former Soviet. So the point here is ignorance is our enemy. And what's going on in Cuba right now is the people are finally said, and this is the pivotal point, they have finally said, my life is worth less than my desire to get freedom for everything else here in Cuba and for me. And so in other words, I put my life at risk, like the tank man at Tiananmen Square. I am going to put life at risk in order to get the freedom that I have been denied for so long and my family has been denied. And what should we be doing? Ronald Reagan would be out there right now strongly supporting this freedom movement. We're doing that. And the problem is we're not.
Yeah. And a related point, Bobby, which you've written about impressively, and among other places, the Association of Mature American Citizens posts on its website, amac.us, is Peru, another Latin American nation that is now, unfortunately, it seems, going to be condemned to going the way of Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela because it seems through fraud, a communist has been elected as its next president. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, and this is one of the most heartbreaking recent stories with a long shadow behind it. And I guess I would say it this way. The people I feel sorriest for in the most immediate moment is all of the free Peruvians, because having spent a lot of time in Peru, from Pucallpa to Cusco, from Lima to a lot of small towns, we worked a lot with that country to stabilize them, to get rid of the Shining Path, to get rid of the drug, the tremendous drug overlay and drug crime overlay. And now all of a sudden you have, by what appears to be in a country of 32 million plus people, a 40,000 vote sudden change in the very end. I mean, again, we see voter fraud all over the United States, but you see this happening, and now the Marxist is suddenly, rather than the rule of law candidate, rather than the pro-business candidate, rather than the free individual liberty candidate, the one that Marxist now appears to be the prevailing one, and the Biden administration just basically nodded their head and said, good to go. So the problem we've got here is that, you know, we often say that history is made by inches, but sometimes it's made by yards and miles, and or it's lost by yards and miles. And this is what's happening. People need to understand. There was a time, Frank, when nobody thought Venezuela could be anything but a wonderful, prosperous first world country. And all of a sudden, with a few big chunks or bites or loss of yards and miles, it ends up disaster. And I think the sad thing, could well be in that same category.
Yeah, I fear so too. Bobby, let me turn finally to the biggest threat we face by far internationally, another Marxist nation, communist China. How would you characterize the Biden team's approach to China and the repercussions thereof?
I would say misunderstanding and underestimation. I mean, to be quite clear, China aims for world dominance. And while that was beneath the surface until the last couple of years, it is crystal clear now. And that means they are seeking dominance in the business world through means that are, we would consider, quite illegitimate. They are using coercion and all kinds of mechanisms to subvert multilateral organizations, to intimidate small countries, to create usurious debt, to pretend that things are being manufactured in one country when they're not, to get around the WTO regulations. But they're doing much more than that. They're militarizing the maritime environment. They're ramping up their military modernization. They're pushing cyber warfare. They're pushing weapons in space. I mean, the bottom line is you have to take for real when a country demonstrates or exhibits indications that they really do want world dominance. And, you know, the Soviet Union was dangerous because they had thousands of nuclear warheads. But they were not an economic power. Their source of power, first of all, the command and control structure was weak. We did not let them through the gates of the free enterprise system. We did not trade stocks in the Soviets. Whatever they had to offer, which wasn't much, they were an energy-rich country with a lot of persecution in them. China, it's the same kind of thing, but with an economy that we allowed to grow from a cub to a bear.
We've enabled, I would argue, as did Congressman Mel Brooks earlier in the program. Bobby, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm sorry to say, but there's so much more to go through here in terms of documenting the wrecking operation of the Biden administration against our country's vital interests, our friends and allies, and not least our security. But I'm so glad you're on the case at amac.us, among other places, and that you are part of our team here, and we look forward to having you back with us in the near future. Look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.